If you saw the UN today, Amr, but as a representative of, I guess, the white race and the Western man, I've been doing my part by eating an entire side of ham and washing it down with like a bottle
Alec, you're
vodka.
A Pope. You're a son of Rome. You look to Rome for guidance. You know, the Pope, you're a papist, and I respect that. I respect that Catholicism.
Please help us, man from Chicago.
I wanted to ask, what if another country was just like, hey, we host the UN now. Don't go there anymore. Don't go to America. We got y'all. This can be a Zoom call.
The anti-secretary general, the Avignon.
Yeah, there's Avignon two UNs UN. Now instead of, yeah.
There's a based UN and a cringe UN. And
yeah. The fact that Trump shows such disdain for the UN and they still are like, yeah, we're all going to go to New York and we're going to like honk like hogs and just applaud. I don't know, man. I think the UN in of itself, the longer I think about it, the more I'm like, there shouldn't be United Nations. There should just be one nation, one nation under God, one imperium. I am becoming more like genuine, like pro imperium. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. Zoran Mamdani is our first step towards that, Amr.
It does.
He needs
make
to hire me...
me
at the head of his secret police, though. His chief inquisitor.
Oh, great. They got a Canadian running the police these days.
Bahraini, thank you very much.
Yeah, the secret Mounties.
Hey, they're pretty good at it, the Bahraini, as far as I know. Those guys are real head crackers.
Actually, no, we outsource that sort of work to the Jordanians. They're actually quite effective at that sort of thing. The Jordanians are fucking brutal, man. They know what they do with the whole pulling fingernails stuff.
It does make me wonder, like, how far are we from Trump just or the Secretary of State Rubio just saying, like, hey, this country is pissing us off, so we're not going to approve your visa to come to the UN. Like, is there
did that with Mahmoud Abbas?
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Yeah, they did that because Abbas was supposed to show up as the head of the PA and acknowledge all the countries that have acknowledged Palestine or whatever. And they just said, yeah, we're not giving you a visa. Fuck off.
Yeah, we've done this. We've done this before. We've thought of this, Connor, and we're currently doing it, actually.
Oh, okay, cool. So this horrible thought experiment is actually a reality. Great.
Yes.
All right.
It's currently the reality. Yes.
Okay. All right.
Again, my argument for a one nation imperium with one capital for the entire world. I'm like, okay, many sub-capitals, because there's a lot of good cities out there, you know? Like, you know, we want every city to be recognized. Rome, Beijing, Toronto, man, all on the same level, obviously. But all of it should be one. Look, the anti-globalists were right, but the idea of one global nation is, in theory, I would like to see that being practiced. One passport, even though I guess you wouldn't need passports. One social identity card for everything.
I mean, we really need to do this, right? But to have like an imperial court without an emperor, right? To where all of like the annoying like blowhard people and like the reporters and stuff, they get to travel, as you say, Amr, from like city to city to various convention centers like all year round, right? And they're just like on a kind of a constant global procession around the world for like you know, a peace talks and then like the cheese conference and then, you know, just make stuff up. The Riyadh Comedy Festival.
Yeah, right? I was gonna say. Hey, speaking of great cities, how about Riyadh? Let's give it up for Riyadh.
How about Riyadh?
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Propagando. It's your boy. It's Connor with Alec and joined with one of our favorite, Colonel Amr. Amr, how are you doing today, bud?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Of course, we wanted to have you on because Alec called me in a tizzy the other day, riled up about this Riyadh comedy festival that's going on. And
I said, Connor, I get all of my opinions from podcasters and comedy guys. And these guys apparently are going to take money from the Sauds. And
how did you find out about this festival, Alec?
So in the same day, I listened to the... I am actually a disgusting like podcast listener, right? So we're both podcast makers, right? Which is honestly worse, right? We're really part of the problem. So I listened. There was a clip off of Shane Gillis's podcast, which is a guilty pleasure of mine, by the way. Politics not very good, where he joked about it. And then there was a clip that was performing so well, I guess, on YouTube that they thought I might like it, about other podcaster Stavros Halkias making fun of other podcasters Sam Morrell and Mark Norman. Right, who are kind of in the
Can
the
you
Rogan...
send me the clip of Stav making fun of them? Because I'm a big Stav guy, so I enjoy Stavi's World. Is it on Stavi's World where he makes fun of them, or
no? He was on the Norman Sam Morrill podcast or whatever. Yeah. These are the. I mean, if you're not aware, these are people that are generally in like
I know all of them. So,
spin-off, for our listeners, like spin-offs of like the New York comedy scene, and most of those now have some kind of like contact with like Rogan. Right, and like the Rogan
sphere. For your listeners who are not American, let me explain. The American economy is split into three parts: Twitch streamers, podcasters, and people who go to New York to do comedy. Now, you might think this is a bad thing, but it's basically like if Year Zero happened to America, but they all marched into New York to do comedy and ended up like in the service industry, bartenders, etc. That's why New York is such an amazing place. But it also means that America has this weird surplus of culture that it exports to the rest of the world that people underestimate, which brings us back to the Riyadh Comedy Festival. But yeah, thank you for the link. I'm going to check that out because it is funny to me. Because I posted about the Riyadh Comedy Festival, and it's still amazing to me how many people are against it for the wrong reasons. Or just don't understand the Gulf. Just fundamentally don't understand the Gulf. But I guess that's why I'm here.
Yeah, by the way, first and foremost, we do not like the Saudi government, I suppose, right? Or, but to be honest, Amr, most of the Gulf monarchies around here.
But yeah.
It's not great. And by the way, I say that as an American, right, who doesn't really like the American government, I guess, ever. But in that context, right, it's one of the bad structures of government, and we don't care for it, right? This being said, I think there's like the thing that we're going to talk about today is like the odd kind of focus on this event and on maybe comedy in general, eliciting some kind of like moral framing, right, from people, and then people having incredibly strong opinions like for or against this, right? Basically, I mean, under the guise of like, there's other shit going on in the world, right? Like, what the fuck are we doing getting mad about this, you know, honestly, fairly innocuous by events going on in the region, certainly innocuous, right?
It's not just the comedy. I mean, it leaks into like sports and performances of various kinds. It's fundamentally the conflation among many on the left between culture and politics, and like the idea that culture is upstream of politics, which is like the sort of reversal, and you know that if we boycott Saudi Arabia, things will change. Which, like, I agree with the boycott because obviously I support a boycott of that other great nation in the Middle East, Israel. But so, like, obviously, morally consistently, I support a boycott of Saudi Arabia and the rest of the Gulf. But I mean, at this point, like, outside of Israel's active genocide, the Saudis, the Qataris, the Bahrainis, the Kuwaitis, is how different is it from hosting a comedy festival in fucking, I don't know, the capital of the Fourth Reich, you know, Washington, D.C. or New York or whatever.
I was going to say anywhere in like the Virginia, Maryland, D.C. area, right?
Yeah. Like, if your audience is 60% people from Langley and people from the Pentagon or whatever, like, what are we doing here? I also don't appreciate the way people like the confusion as to like, why would comedians go to Saudi Arabia? No one there knows their comedy, or no one there understands comedy or whatever. It's like, You fucking really? Morons. We grew up, we being the Gulf, grew up on American cultural products, cultural export, cultural hegemony, really. And to the extent that, like, the Gulf is was a thing, at least growing up in the mid-2000s, right? Like, you know, I'm a 95 kid. I grew up in, like, the 90s, the aughts. And to the extent that there's any place on the planet that sort of absorbed America more than any other place, it's the Gulf. It's really, I've said this before on many podcasts, I've said this online, the idea of having a good time back home was you went to a LAN cafe, you played Counter-Strike, and then you went with your homies to Pizza Hut or Fuddruckers or Chili's. Or we have Fuddruckers, man, and they had a fucking condiment. Like, first of all, let me clarify. They sold their cheeseburgers in four sizes. Four. A third pounder, no, mm-hmm. quarter pounder, a third pounder, a half pounder, and a full pound burger. And I've seen my friends eat a full pound burger, and it is a fucking brutal. It's a war of attrition. It's a long march. And they're sweating, and they're like, look like they're struggling, but they're fucking eating it because we love America, baby. And there's a goddamn condiment fucking thing, and you go around, and you can put all the fucking condiments you want on your burger, all the toppings. That's a great, great establishment. We love our fud, don't we, folks? They were also the only one of the only places in Bahrain that served vanilla Coke. So, yeah, vanilla Coke, free refills, maybe three or four glasses. Get it on the table, man. This round's on me, fellas.
It's interesting that the Gulf is one of those places that, like, is so overflowing with money, and obviously the connections are there, that it's one of the places in the world, maybe one of the only places that can fully take advantage of American consumerism and import basically everything of it that they want, right?
Yes.
I guess embodying that makes all those, you know, to Americans, like, fairly dystopic, like, photographs, right? Where you're in the Gulf and it looks like somewhere in Arizona or something like this, right? Like, you're in
Honestly,
the Gulf and
New
you're
Mexico and Arizona would be the two states I would compare the most in terms of temperature, climate,
right.
And like the sea of subdivisions. Now we have villas
exactly.
that are a bit different, but it's pretty much the same thing. Everyone is stuck in a car. They go from parking lot to parking lot to waddle into some sort of mall. Yeah.
Is there a Gulf State parallel for Meghan McCain?
You mean
we have a lot
hot
of
chick?
That I don't know what you're talking about.
You mean a beautiful lady that I would love to wine and dine, Connor?
We have talk shows, like local political talk shows, and they're all populated by the kind of people who would not be thrown in jail for dissent. So, you know.
Little jug hooters.
I mean, if we're talking about culture, this seems to be an episode where we are having, like, a focus on the culture of these Gulf states. Like, what does The View look like? And
well, we have a version of The View called
Isn't
The View.
Memory TV? No?
No. Memory does pick and choose from actual shows that do exist and people that actually do go on TV and say this sort of thing. But again, like, is it any better or worse than the average night on Fox News or average fucking
No. Well,
you
even
know, One America?
Even The View is not going to even allow a truly dangerous opinion. Like, they're going to
put
it's like safe. So I just didn't know what it looked like.
Your mainstream panel shows or talk shows or like interviews or whatever are relatively safe. They don't really touch the fourth rails or third rails, whatever the fucking example is, of politics. You know, there's no dissent against the monarchies as such. Kuwait is a bit more cosmopolitan in that. Kuwait has always had more of a tradition of anti-government dissent. That there's more leeway there. So, like, I know people in my family and elsewhere who have gone on TV and actively denounced specific princes, specific emirs, specific members of the royal family. They wouldn't call for the downfall of a Sabah or a republic by any means, but specific corruption and accuse active members of the royal family, which wouldn't, you know, happen with the Sauds or the...
Is that as dangerous as it sounds?
in the Bahrain, yeah, in Saudi, yeah. I mean, in the Emirat for sure. Like, it's Kuwait is a lot more. There's more room for maneuver. But it's because of a long history that I could spend another three podcasts talking about, to be honest. But Kuwait politics has always been more interesting, in that sense, at least. But for the rest of the Gulf, yeah, I mean, you know, there's red lines. You don't talk about the royal families. You don't talk about you don't dismiss or criticize Islam in any way, shape, or form. You don't touch on certain foreign policy ventures. So like in more recent cases, the Abraham Accords, normalization with Israel, things of that nature. There's also, it's more focused on like social woes, social issues. Like our equivalent of the view would talk about, like, for example, kids playing video games and how that's bad because whatever. Or like cartoons encouraging Satanism. Yes, we had a satanic panic too. Like I said, it's fucking Glendale, Arizona, baby, all the fucking way. I will say one thing I want to clarify about Gulf culture, because I suppose this is what this episode is really about. One of the big reasons the Gulf absorbed American culture so well, and probably better than anywhere else in the world, is also this deep sense of inferiority Gulf Arabs feel relative to other Arabs. Because if you look at other Arabs, right, I'm talking specifically about Egyptians, Iraqis, Levantines, right? Beirut, Damascus, Baghdad, Cairo, these were all centers of immense cultural output for hundreds of years, right? Thousands in the case of Damascus. And even into like the 20th century, right, the post-war push for modernity and, you know, the radio, music, film, Cairo was producing films left, right, and center. Cairo produced Kulthum. Beirut had Fairuz. These are all like icons of Arab culture, like what is actually understood as Arab culture. Arabic singers singing in Arabic, films produced in Arabic, shows made by Arabic directors, starring Arabic actors who were stars, by the way. They had as much cachet in the Middle East as Hollywood stars would have in Hollywood at their heyday, right? The Gulf never had that. They were always the backwater. Up until oil and money, they were always the backwater. Like, you know, it took four caliphs from the ascent of Muhammad to move the capital of the Muslim Ummah from Mecca to Damascus, right? By the Umayyads, they were like, yeah, we're not staying back where we came
from.
Yeah,
I've never thought about that. The fact that it's moved so quickly kind of out, and Arabia is almost like shorn off like a husk, right? Like a molt, right? You know,
and it's the motherland. It's the motherland of Islam. It's the motherland of what Arabs consider true Arabic speakers and true Arab tribes. And within four caliphs, you know, Abu Bakr, Omar, Uthman, Ali, his reign was very tumultuous, and he moved his forces to Kufa for a while in Iraq, but arguable whether that was really a capital. But as soon as he fell and Muawiyah took over, it was Damascus. And from Damascus, then it was Baghdad. And from Baghdad, then, you know, there was Cairo that was founded by the Fatimids. Like, the Arabian Peninsula was always seen as this sort of husk, like you say, this backwater, this area that was only relevant insofar as who controlled Mecca and Medina in a spiritual and religious sense. But no caliph wanted to live there. No scientists were like encouraged to move there.
I think the very things that made it independent in a way that could have birthed Islam, right, made it basically impossible as like an actual center of imperial power, I would guess, right?
Yeah, I mean geography, literally climate, exactly,
yeah. Mountains,
but,
yeah,
yeah. Deserts, but then also like, you move north and you start discover, oh, I don't have to drink fermented camel's milk. I can drink wine. Why the fuck do I have to drink this dog shit? Like, I can eat the most sumptuous treats from the East, from the Orient, and from you know, Europe. Like, it was shocking how quickly that the shift of power and, you know, downstream of power, obviously culture, just moved north and west. And also east, obviously, with Iran, but speaking specifically of the Arabs, because Iran was never Arabized, at least not to, there's an Arab-speaking minority, but not to the extent that their culture became Arab. But yeah, like, so you come to the 20th century and the discovery of oil, and these people have all this money now, but not a significant history of art and culture and music and film and all of that. So they look at, you know, their benefactor, the U.S., the military benefactor, political benefactor, and they decide, well, we're going to be you. Not only are we going to be you, we're going to be more you than you are. which is why, like, you know, I grew up on a steady diet of Eminem and Linkin Park and you know, fucking RuneScape and World of Warcraft and all of that.
I do feel like, to what you're saying about, like, we're going to be more like you than you are, is, like, when I first heard about the Saudi future city, Neom, I was like, this is like an American theme park. Like, yes. This is like the UFC octagon in front of the White House. Like, this is so ostentatious and over the top.
That's funny.
Neom is just the logical conclusion. But have you ever heard of the Riyadh season?
No.
So the Riyadh season is this festival that started in Riyadh in 2019, and it goes annually. And it's a festival that pretty much is the sort of side of the comedy festival. The comedy festival is just comedy, right? You have all these comedians coming in, as you guys mentioned, Norman, Samuel. Well,
we'll talk about it in a sec, right?
Like, yeah. But the Riyadh season is the sports and cultural twin of that. And it goes every winter, September, October into November, into, I think it goes until January of the following year. Yeah, it is a entire winter thing. And every year they have the Riyadh season from September to January, and they have like all like actually massive events. They've had Tyson Fury versus Francis Ngannou. They had Fury versus Usyk, both 1 and 2. The Royal Rumble is going to be held in the next Riyadh season, the one that's coming up. Fucking last year they had the WWE Crown Jewel. They had tennis tournaments.
This is actually when all of the kind of mega events are going on in Riyadh.
Yes, because it's the only time the temperature allows you to.
Of course.
Yes. Yeah. And these people, like the Saudis, pay immense money for this sort of cultural affluence, and people love it. That's what I want to emphasize. Like, growing up in the sort of shadow of cultural American cultural hegemony. Like, if when I grew up in Bahrain, it was very rare to host, because, like, at that point, it was the first generation of Americanized, you know, the Americanized youth. There still wasn't the logistics and the political leadership were still old school Arab. They still believed in old school Arab tradition. Part of it was like, you know, music is corrupting. We don't want to have these metal bands over or whatever. When the new generation took over, so Bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, Bin Zayed in Emirat, even in Bahrain, the Crown Prince taking more and more of the daily control of the government, so forth, there was like this desire to build your own political base because you're a young prince. And they saw the youth as a reliable base. And they did that by being like, you guys like this. Don't you like Eminem? So we're going to pay him a shitload of money to come. You like fucking Guns N' Roses. You like all these fucking video game tournaments. And you know, and by the way, I want to clarify, growing up with that cultural milieu, there was always a distinction between those who fully embraced it and those who didn't. By which I'm, and it is a class signifier. At its core, it's fundamentally a class signifier.
It's prestige. Now, I mean,
yes,
truly.
It's prestige because it shows that you not only learned English, by which you went to a private school, because public schools do teach English back home, but public schools teach English as a second language. Private schools teach all their courses are presented in English except for Arabic language, which is taught as a second language. So I funnily enough, grew up with, like, I'm bilingual, but Arabic in my school was taught as a second language. English was the dominant. English was how we were taught science, how we were taught math, how we were taught literature, how we were taught American history, because that was apparently an important fucking course to take.
Bizarre.
Yeah, we had textbooks from fucking Macmillan or Pearson or whatever they're called. those various textbook manufacturers.
Oh, Lord.
We talked about Ulysses Grant, sorry, Robert T. Lee, McClellan, all of that. But to go back to my point, to go to a private school initially was a way of showing social class. But even within that private school, to speak with your friends in English outside of school or in break or whatever, versus speaking with your friends in Arabic, that distinguished the what was used against us as a slur, and I'm going to use it, and you guys are going to laugh your ass off. We were called by the people who spoke Arabic among each other chicken nuggets.
What?
That's very funny.
Yeah, so chicken
nuggets. Yeah, I get it. White on the
chicken
inside.
White on the inside, and also like a food product that came from America, like a McDonald's, mm-hmm. right? Like that's the most American thing you could think of is McDonald's and chicken nuggets. And those of us who spoke English with one another during break or whatever, or when we would go out on the weekends, we were seen as like these completely westernized, completely detached from our culture. people. And that was largely due to the social status that I would confer on the idea that we would all go abroad for university. And some of us could come back, some of us wouldn't. But it's this idea that we're the new elite. We're meant to be the new elite. And of course, by the way, that shift has corrected itself a little bit going back to the culture aspect and the language aspect. Now, with the future generations, I talk to my cousins who have kids, for example, there is a real correction of trying to encourage your kids not only to speak Arabic and learn Arabic as much as you learn English, but a genuine interest in cultivating domestic culture, by which I mean, instead of just bringing the WWE and hosting it, there's now actual local wrestling promotions in Saudi, in Bahrain. I have a buddy of mine from school. We don't really talk anymore, but he's like one of the champions of Bahraini underground wrestling, or not indie, I guess you would call it. Maybe not indie because it is well funded, but basically, like, what if like a local wrestling stable existed in Bahrain? Similarly, I have a friend of mine who is in a punk band in Bahrain and plays in shows and like plays with both English and Arabic lyrics, but is getting hired by cultural production venues in Bahrain as a Bahraini artist to play. Now, growing up in Bahrain, that was unheard of. No one in a band
really
being paid to play a song, or no one would be like, I'm being paid to be a wrestler. The idea of money being used for local cultural production did not exist in my generation. It was mostly, we're going to spend this money eventually to bring these people in. And by the time I was in high school, that trickled in initially with like the burnouts and the wash-offs and the rejects of American cultural production. So like Linkin Park 10 years after they were famous.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, because one of the places I'm leading to, right, eventually, is that I think a lot of this is about a feeling of ownership, right? It's not just that it is Arabs, that it is Muslims, right? But the overwhelming sense I think that people have that there is this entity outside that is so much more opulent than the United States, right? And the implication that like nobody would leave the United States, nobody would kind of betray our cultural milieu if it wasn't for this enormous amount of money, right? And there's an acceptable level of that, which is you can have it later, right? Once it's passé, it passes on to like the European tour, right? Like after their after they've had two albums that don't crack platinum, everybody does a fucking European tour where they go to, you know, Paris and Berlin and fucking Belgrade, right? And trying to isolate a place to allow our culture, our culture to exist outside of the United States, and more and more and more so, right? It's a transposition of our own, right, feelings of kind of inadequacy and inferiority, right, on somebody 100%. Else, right?
It's what in football Europeans would call the American football, soccer, like MLS, a retirement league.
Exactly.
Know? You send the players there after their prime. They're already won their Champions League. They're going there for one last paycheck, and they see the golf the same way. By the way, with football, that's why when Ronaldo moved, everyone was like, Ronaldo is going to retire there. He's being put out to pasture. It's the same with like, you know, that's why it's constantly shocks Europeans when football players move to Saudi and their prime. They're like, why would you do that? We have the best clubs. And to a degree they do, in the sense that, like, you know, you want to play for Chelsea or Manchester United or Real Madrid or Barcelona or whatever. But to your point, Alec, you're right. Like, you know, when a musician doesn't crack platinum, they're on the wane, people don't listen to them anymore. You go there, you cash a few checks, you get an exorbitant amount of money, and you retire. But now in this new era, you have both like people in their prime going there and this production of local culture happening hand in hand. So you have WWE hosting massive events there, local wrestling scene. You have Ronaldo going there. You have major players in their prime going there. And you have like an immense investment in academies and the development of local players. And players who are like, they pay a lot of money to send them out on loan to Spanish leagues or whatever. It's this weird like balance being made by the Saudis, by the Emiratis, to a lesser degree Bahrain, but most of the big players are Qatar, the UAE, and Saudi. Those are the three ones that will like bring the biggest acts in, right? And I mean, the irony for me, for personally as a Bahraini, is that the roles have been reversed, because Saudi used to be the most restrictive of all the countries in the region. Yes. And Saudis would come to Bahrain to watch music or film or art or whatever, and, you know, drink and whore their way to an early grave. But now Bahrainis, because, you know, Guns N' Roses will come to Riyadh, but sometimes they won't come to Bahrain. Some acts would, but some acts wouldn't. They'll just do Riyadh and maybe Doha, maybe Dubai. So Bahrainis will get in their car and cross the border and drive to Riyadh to watch. My fucking friend last winter, when I saw fucking Instagram stories of him seeing Tiësto live. And
shout out to his family.
Yeah. I was like dying of laughter. I'm like, man, they have EDM over there. They have shitty EDM. It's great for them. Great. I love it. Fucking whatever, man.
They're going to turn Riyadh into fucking Tel Aviv, man. This sucks.
But, you know, but at the same time, I also saw a video of this Palestinian DJ that I really love, Sama Abdul Hadi, who's like this excellent techno DJ. And she headlined a party at this bar in Bahrain. And she was the headliner, but all of the opening acts were local Bahraini DJs. And I started following them on Instagram, and they're actually really fucking good. And they get shows in the local circuit where they get paid to travel around. And they've gone as far as, like, you know, Beirut and Cairo and, like, India and shit. And, like, this is – it's just shocking to me, because, like, I did not think that would ever happen with the Gulf. But here we are, you know. You get Tiësto and you get local Bahraini techno, which is pretty fucking good, I'll tell you that much.
So I think now is a good time to pivot into actually talking about the festival.
So what happened? Right. Yeah.
Okay. So Alex said he heard about this through podcasting. I actually heard about this like pretty much the day it was announced, through a combination of being obsessed with the Super City and Saudi Arabia Neom, but also just being comedy adjacent, having done, you know, stand up and sketch comedy in the past. I just like my algorithm is just geared towards giving me comedy announcements. So I heard about this, and this is part of Mohammed bin Salman, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, his effort to make Saudi Arabia basically a like entertainment destination across the world, specifically Riyadh. And this is all part of Saudi Arabia's Vision 2030 strategy, which is just MBS's goal and vision for we're bringing Saudi Arabia not just into the 21st century, but beyond. He doesn't want to modernize the city. He wants to make it the city of the future, the country of the future, the nation of the future, the kingdom of the future, whatever you want to call it. And so this was announced over the summer, around July, end of July. And lots of podcast comedians and stand-up comedians who are traditionally associated with the concept that comedians speak truth to power. There's that image that goes around every now and then of Chris Rock saying people used to listen to philosophers, but we don't have philosophers anymore. Not true. We have Slavoj. Shout out to Slavoj. shout out Timothy Morton. But he said we don't have philosophers anymore, but we have comedians. And that is like the frustration that people have with these comedians going to do this festival, and that image as well, speaks to something seriously wrong with American politics, which is we look to entertainers to break down concepts for us in a way that I think is pretty troubling. But that's a different conversation. Right now we're talking about the Riyadh Comedy Festival, and why are people so god dang mad about it?
God dang it. I think first and foremost, it's there's that thing that we mentioned just a second ago about ownership, right? We'll take a moment. Like, let me explain myself as like an American first, and then Amr, you see if like that's resonant, because a lot of times, sure, maybe from the outside, you'll have a different perspective. I think first and foremost is about ownership. There's a sense that that once some amount of money has affected a thing or a person, right, that it is tainted, regardless of who that is, right? And in our culture, the Gulf has come to symbolize, right, like one of these enormous capital kind of corrupting forces, right? Secondarily, like politically for a lot of people, this is in the United States specifically, but like in the West, I would even say broadly, right? Like the Gulf, and especially the Saudis, again, have come to symbolize for different camps this like this violent and like authoritarian other, right? To upon which they transpose, right? Like the worst of the worst, right? Like Saudi was Putin before there was Putin for like liberals, right? Yeah. This like person to whom MBS, but I don't even think they know Mohammed bin Salman's name, right? It's just Arabs. It's just some guy in a headdress.
One of my favorite scenes in any like one of those like action movies is like, you know, when there's like a meeting of all the villains in a fucking big room and you have like 50 or 100 people, and they always have to show like the one Arab guy, yes, in the fucking dress, and he's like there with the other like villains who are like leaders of various, you know, bad countries or cartels or whatever, and he's like there. Usually he's dressed completely wrong, he's a fucking, like, you know, no one is fucking doing the research. But yeah, to your point, like the guy in the thobe and the headdress and all of that, that's the Putin before Putin. And I think a big aspect of that was the endemic American rage after 73 and the oil shock. Like, you know, I think the oil shock played a big role there. Like the whole, like the Arabs are, I remember like going through a bunch of cartoons of newspapers of that era, and like, you know, this fat sheik sitting on like, you know, a reservoir of oil, and like the Americans are like lined up around the gas stations and stuff. And I do think just Americans never forgave.
Yeah. I mean, there's now there are multiple levels, right, that are kind of pasted on over that are painted over, right? There's obviously, when it comes to Saudi Arabia, there's 9/11, right? Yes. That's been a thing, by the way, specifically about this event, by the more kind of right wing comedians and their audiences, is like frequently a thing mentioned. And then there is like a broad sense of just humiliation about the global war on terror wars that I think just kind of gets thrown at the Muslim world, like broadly. Right. There, yeah. There's just is this kind of ambient feeling that, like, don't give anything to those fucking guys. Right. Like, do I have to tell you what happened, you know, in Iraq? Right. Do I have to tell you about like what they did to us? Right.
Oh, and oftentimes they can't. Like, I remember just in high school being like, so why are we going over there? What are they fighting about? And just my family members or even my teachers just being like, oh, they've been fighting forever, man. And it's like a clear display of just like a lack of knowledge of the area. Because I also wanted to say, like,
why are we there then?
Yeah. And I wanted to point out, like Alec was saying, like, do we need to, you know, or I'm sorry, Amr, you pointed out that like the oil shock, right? But also, like, you're giving Americans way too much credit that they can tell the difference between all these different states. Like, it's not just
oh, yeah.
It's also like the Iran hostage crisis. Like, it's also like trouble in the Suez. Like, anything that a brown person does that you can like play that like kind of Indiana Jones, I'm in the desert music. They're just like, oh yeah, they're all the fucking same. They all did that.
I mean,
I think Americans only distinguish people by the like the cartoonish hats that they believe they so like the Chinese rice hats, right? Classic, you know, cartoon of a guy in a rice hat. You're like, that's the inscrutable Mandarin. Arab guy in a big headdress, fat guy from the classic film we all know and love, Taken. That sort of bloke.
It's hats and also like all Anglos, like not just Americans, all Anglos, accents.
Yeah. It's Slavica, Ushanka, right? Like it's all Russians and all Eastern Europeans together, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Sombreros.
I mean, they're incredibly stupid. And they just lumped them all in together. Like it happened. Yeah.
And so like I think it's very visible, right, that there are now two camps of these people, right? There's the like aforementioned, I think, like right-wing coded, right? I'm thinking like Shane Gillis, right? For the millennial generation, fans of guys that are kind of either in or adjacent to like the Rogan sphere. For those guys, Saudi Arabia represents, right, the corrupting influence of money, because on some level these people still kind of ideologically believe themselves somewhat like libertarian, right, and are in some ways disgusted by money, even though it's a very, you know, love-hate relationship. It's all of that nationalist humiliation, right? And then on a liberal side, right, the kinds of people that I would say are like enlightened, enlightened comedic listeners, right? For them, it's the same thing about money influence. And maybe there's even, right, some of them are aware that like the Saudis and the Israelis get along and they're angry about Palestine. But I'd say like the thing that I've seen referenced most, and I'm shocked to see how resonant it is, because honestly, I haven't thought about it in years, is the Khashoggi murder. like the Khashoggi murder is so referenced. It's, I would say it's having like looked through tweets, right, and like YouTube comments for like, what is the raw shit? Like, what is the complaint? The thing that's referenced is the murder of journalists, which is like, yeah. I mean, I know expecting Americans to kind of know anything about the
and
world.
To a lesser
is,
degree of treatment of women and LGBTQ.
Somewhat. Yeah. Although, right. Like that's been pretty effective because remember they let them drive cars now. They let ladies drive cars now. So like, dude, I really kind of rolled my eyes years ago when I saw a kind of rollout of like a new Saudi propaganda campaign about, you know, easing restrictions on women, and then kind of doubted the staying power of, you know, basically, I guess, the CIA's propaganda about Khashoggi, right? Who was a guy that worked for them, right? That's why we care about that guy basically at all. He was an intelligence asset first. And boy, was that successful, totally unbeknownst to me.
I mean, Khashoggi was a very, very peripheral intelligence asset. He was not his uncle, that's for sure. First as tragedy, then as farce. First as Napoleon, and then as Louis Napoleon. But I would add one other group to your assessment, Alec, which is leftists who correctly identify the Gulf monarchies not only as authoritarian, but have a profoundly fundamental problem with the kafala system and what is arguably understood as slavery. I would say it is. Now, the three groups you mentioned, right? The right-wingers who have a nationalist bent to this is our culture. It is being poisoned by foreign money, you know. The globalists are ruining our fucking culture. The liberals who, their biggest thing is Khashoggi, but to a lesser degree, women and minorities, or like domestic minorities rather, like, you know, LGBTQ, et cetera. And the leftists whose big thing is these people have slaves. Of those three, the leftists are the most accurate. And I don't just say this because I am a leftist, but that's the biggest concern I would argue is that these countries are run on slave labor. All of these arenas that these comedians are going to perform in are built on slaves. But if we're going to built on slaves too, to be fair. No. I don't know how many people died in the foundations there. But the thing that irks me, and you know, I don't want to do some sort of whataboutism, but like, it does have to be said, like, how many arenas in America were built by slaves? Like, if a comedian is touring, you know, the South and whatnot, like, okay. And yes, obviously slavery in the 21st century and within our lifetime is egregious in a way that, like, historic slavery is something that, you know, it's already done, halas, you know what I mean? I'm doing a lot of caveats here because it is a messy and complicated thing for me, because as someone who grew up in the Gulf, you know, I didn't choose to be born there. I was born there. I was born into this milieu. I hate the slavery there. It's why one of the biggest reasons why I chose to leave. I could not withstand that sort of, you know, clear, very explicit in a way that isn't almost anywhere else in the world, stratification of labor through race and migration, right? Through migrant workers, through hierarchies of class, through how you access the system and what your job is, really. Down to the very, very explicit, and many people will just tell you outright, hierarchy of what domestic servants are best. And they get paid accordingly. Filipinas get paid more than Ethiopians because Filipinas are seen as better nannies because they'll teach your kids better English and tend to be cleaner, whatever that means. It's pure fucking, you know, 17th century racism shelled in this economic milieu where, therefore, because these attitudes exist, a Filipina maid can make more than a Ethiopian maid, right? Now, on the other hand of all of that, you know, like I said, like, the Fourth Reich in America, right? The especially in its current iteration, its current manifestation. You know, who's to say a comedian who performs in Austin in the Rogan Sphere is any more or less morally innocent or virtuous than a guy who goes to Riyadh for money? Money is fucking money. I don't know, man. I do want to go through the lineup of this comedy festival because I do think it is hilarious. I do think it is a grab bag of things. Sorry, Connor, you want to say something?
Yeah, no. On the lineup itself, when you were talking about the liberal argument against this festival being twofold, one is Jamal Khashoggi, and then of course it's the how they treat women, LGBTQ minorities. This lineup, my greater argument about some of this stuff is that arts and culture is incredibly impactful on moving the social needle for two reasons. One is that it pushes social mores and shows us that, like, hey, maybe this kind of rule is really silly. If everyone's laughing at it, maybe we should reconsider. And at the other time, like, hey, let's be honest, money talks. And so, like, if you're a very prominent entertainer, if you tap into something that really resonates with your audiences, you're going to get more likes, you're going to get more views, you're going to get more shows. Now, the lineup, one of the things about the lineup that is really interesting to me, specifically with this liberal argument, is that there are three women on this lineup. There's Whitney Cummings, a very outspoken feminist, a white woman, doesn't cover her head or nothing like that. So, and there's also Jessica Kirsten, who is a openly gay woman who has adopted four children with her now ex-wife. But, like, it was just something that when I sat there thinking about, like, dude, if you want to rail against supposed human rights violations against these certain groups, like, this festival is putting them in the spotlight, putting them in the limelight, literally putting them in the spotlight. And I think that that can be pretty powerful if you're platforming voices like these and something in a environment that liberal or very online people are assuming is just like this dystopian place where, you know, Muslim people do not laugh. They're not even allowed to laugh. How can you have a comedy festival? And I just thought it was just like, it really doesn't, it really just cuts their argument down.
I would try and shy away a little bit from that because I feel like we're doing kind of the opposite. We're playing this tug of war about whether or not this thing is like culturally important as well, right? Like whether or not the comedy is tainted by it going to Saudi Arabia, or it's like some kind of pearls before swine thing, right? Or if it's a transposition, right? Like we can't, I think this is very common too, right? We feel as though we can't do anything about politics. We don't have any power, but these comedians can say something, and that's going to empower everybody to change like the way they think. And like, that hasn't happened, right? And I don't know if I believe in that kind of politics, you know?
You know, the example I spoke about earlier with the View, our version of The View and all that, I mean, I doubt that the comedians, any of these comedians going into Riyadh are going to touch any of the third rails of the countries they're in, right? Like, even if they do make jokes about women's rights or whatever in a way that is positive, first of all, I don't think they're going to do any LGBTQ rights. I'll tell you that much. Even Jessica, I'd be surprised if she does. I'd be shocked. Secondly, whatever jokes they do are, to the extent that they're transgressive within very understood implicit boundaries, right? They're not gonna come out and be like, we're gonna do a Draw Muhammad cartoon contest or whatever, right? You know, they're not doing that. Which, like, whatever, whether they do or not, I subscribe to the belief, and this might be diametrically opposite to what you just said, Connor, that I'm a Stavi head in a sense that I believe that what he said about comedy, which is A, it's the lowest form of art. Yeah. And B, they're medieval jongleurs, not philosophers. I'm talking Chris Rock bullshit about we're philosophers. Fuck off. No, you're jesters and clowns. You're our version of like circus freaks.
We agree, Amr. Like, I do not believe that comedians are philosophers. I think, if anything, Alec and I talked about this. If anything, I believe comedians are propagandists. Like, they break down things very, very simply to the point where, like,
they question normative assumptions, which is good, but. Yes. The idea that, you know, there's any profound insight from the worst comedians for me, the comedians I like the least are the ones that whose comedy revolves around the goal or objective of attaining applause, like some sort of applause for like some political, like, you know, oh, what a fucking cool thing to say. What an own against Donald Trump, or what an own against this or that political figure. My favorite type of comedy is pure, like, you know, Stav. I did like early Dave Chappelle, which I thought was hilarious. The only exception to that rule for me is Carlin. Like, Carlin for me is a legend. But outside of that, most of my favorite comics, like Kevin Bridges, just a Scottish guy who makes observations. Like that's you know, I think for me, comedy is something that it makes me question what I believe in, yes, and it makes me question my normative assumptions, yes. But in a way that is basically like, I was on a subway and I observed this interaction, and they say it obviously in a funny way, but it makes you like oh, this is funny, not like, you know, lecturing or polemic. I don't want polemics. Okay, don't fucking make your comedy polemic.
If a comedian is trying to have some insight, right, and this is not even trying to instill some kind of political message necessarily, but just make some insight, 99 times out of 100, it's going to be insipid and moronic. It's just going to be very stupid.
It's going to be Ricky fucking Gervais, who I fucking hate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah.
This reminds me, I once performed at a comedy festival for the local DSA chapter here. Or like a comedy show that was like raising money for the DSA. And boy, every joke I had fell so fucking flat.
I
bombed terribly. And it was like, but hey, we could really use some free healthcare in this country. And the whole room was like, yeah!
I blame comedians as much as I blame audiences. I think audiences are equally responsible for this slew of like,
yes,
slop comedy.
Yes, because I've talked about this. I have people in my family who will like rely upon a Chris D'Elia type, and maybe that's not the best example, but more like a Joe Rogan type, to point out a hypocrisy, and that's like their politics. There's nothing else. There's no systemic analysis. There's no like, you can point out flaws all day. What's your solution? What's your political?
Also, again, fundamentally, it's not funny. Your job as a comedian is first and foremost to be funny,
make me laugh. Which is, by the way, that's why I listen to like some problematic podcast.
Gillis is hilarious.
Matt and Shane's is still funny. It's one of the only podcasts that can regularly get me to laugh out loud. Right?
By the way, I don't think Gillis is as bad as some people would say he is. I do think after he got canned from SNL, he did have an opportunity to go like full on like, you know, right wing cancel culture guy. He didn't. I find that impressive. I think he stuck to his idea of what comedy is, and I think he's one of the funniest guys out there, honestly.
I have to say, I mean, it's not publicly available, so like if you want the link, or I'll send it to you, but like the old podcast, it's all gone now, right? It's all off the internet. Shane and Matt were two of the only guys that were anti-cancel culture back when all that shit was at its like zenith, like so fucking annoying, that we're actually funny about it. Funny in a cruel way, right? Yeah. But it'll make you laugh. I mean, I promise, it's crazy.
One of my favorite skits of all time is the Gillis ISIS Toyota thing. God. It's fucking hysterical. Genuinely gets tears in my eye the first time I watched it. But again, I like my fundamental point is comedy is meant to be funny first and then profound second. And if you don't get the funny part, and funny for me is like also like the mechanics of that is like the building of tension and release of tension. You know, you tell a story where the crowd is getting more and more tense. I don't know what the fuck's gonna happen, and then you crack the room, right? And these people they're not building tension because they're avoiding friction. That's the other part of it. Is like if you're just polemic, you're avoiding friction. You're just trying to get these people, like you said, Connor, like, healthcare, is that good or not? Ah, yeah, woo! Snap, 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 whatever. But I want to go back to and list the lineup because it is genuinely funny, the combination of people. you have Jeff Ross and Friends. I don't know who that is. You have Dave Chappelle.
You don't know who Jeff Ross is, the Roastmaster General? Oh, he's like a
some
big
of these people
guy.
I don't know, by the way. So yeah.
Jeff Ross is really big and what is he really known for? He's really known for like roast comedy and also dating underage women.
Oh, okay. Jesus well
Christ.
He's going to a place where that is agreeable.
I was going to ask you how many people on this lineup do you think are going to make the same hacky joke about like, oh, women are driving here now, I guess that's why traffic got so bad or something like that. Like,
that's an easy layup, you know.
Bill Burr just like, boy, Riyadh changed. I used to be able to get an Uber and make sure it was a friggin' man driving. Now it's
that's
a little
a good
different.
Impression. Like, that is a good impression, to be fair.
Thank you. Shout out to the Discord, Fimu. I know you want me to keep making impressions. All right.
Now he's a different kind of brown, my Uber driver.
Jeff Ross and Friends. Dave Chappelle, which, again, one of my favorites growing up. He sort of fell off, obviously, but early Dave Chappelle was elite. Gabriel Iglesias.
Fluffy. How could he? How could Gabriel Iglesias sell out to the Sauds? How is this possible?
Omid Jalili, of course. I used to like him when I was a kid. Yeah, he's all right. He's not, you know, he's mid. Jimoin, I don't know how you pronounce it. J-I-M-E-O-I-N.
James Ian Stephen Paul McCowan. So I guess Jimoin. I don't know.
I guess. Jessica Kirsten. Aziz Ansari. Kevin Hart. Nimesh Patel. Chris DiStefano. Tom Segura. Joe Coy. Sam Morril, Hannibal Buress, of course, Andrew Schultz and Flagrant Live, Sebastian Manticalo, again, I'm telling you, it's a Harlem Globetrotters of comedians.
Oh my God, Sebastian Manticalo, I can't believe it. That's so funny.
Bad friends with Andrew Santino and Bobby Lee, Maz Jobrani and friends. Bill Burr, who again I actually really like, I quite enjoy his comedy.
That's the only one I was like, I was initially like actually disappointed.
That one like, actually hurt.
Why me. Do yeah, I? Was, yeah, yeah. I was like, and then I was like, why do I care about that? I don't give a fuck about that.
Whitney Cummings, co-headline Jimmy Carr and Louis C.K.
Louis C.K.
This is the worst thing Louis C.K. has ever done. I can't believe this.
Famously, God.
Pete Davidson, and it would be hilarious if his next girlfriend is a Saudi princess, because like,
oh, hell yes.
Can you imagine? It'd be so sick, dude. He'd be so awesome, man. But yeah, he's going in there. Mark Normand, Russell Peters, who I did actually enjoy when I was a teen with no sense of, like, you know, what is good comedy from bad comedy. So he's going in there, and he's going to do his voices, and everyone's going to hoot and holler. Zarna Garg, I don't know who that is, and Chris Tucker. I saw Chris Tucker was going there. I'm like, I wonder if he's going to get a little trip on the Lolita Express or something.
Yeah. fresh off of not talking about Epstein for the, you know, fourth year in a row.
That name was the one that threw me off the most of all of the names like associated with that. I'm like, imagine being a fucking like billionaire, like, you know, financier, alleged sex trafficker. And you're like, I want the guy from Rush Hour, and not even the funny one from Rush Hour. I want the annoying one from Rush Hour. I'm not bringing Jackie Chan in there. I'm bringing the second guy, the other guy. What the fuck are we doing, man?
Yeah, Chris Tucker, I'm giving him a break because he got contractually fucked over with Rush Hour. Like he was contractually forbidden from starring in movies until Rush Hour 4 was made, and
That's insane.
And it was in production hell for, you know, it still isn't made. And he finally was able to like start acting again and doing like smaller things. So, I feel for Chris Tuck. Not that I feel for him. I'm not going to give him shit for getting his bag.
No, that's an actual principled position, Connor.
No, I mean, let him get his bag. I don't care. I mean, the Epstein connection is funny to me in the sense like it's insane.
It's pretty bad.
Oh, well, I'm not insane
why he was there. Like, obviously it's bad on his account. Like, he shouldn't have been there. I'm confused as to why you have this fucking, essentially a B-rate actor, like a B-lister.
I want to clarify. I'm not giving Chris Tucker a pass for Epstein Island stuff. That's bad. That had nothing to do with Rush Hour 4. I want to be abundantly clear on the record about that.
Fair enough.
That is, by the way, Amr saying that Chris Tucker is not good enough to perform in Riyadh.
I mean, some of these people, like, they're not, like, there's, like, honestly, if I was a Saudi, Chappelle, probably not anymore. The magic has worn off there. I'd probably go for Burr, Morril, Normand.
I mean, a lot of these guys Schultz are,
because I think it's funny how annoying he is.
Brandon Shaw, oh my God.
Yeah.
A lot of these guys are, right? Like, the big names are, like, bordering on has-been territory, which is kind of what I was, like getting at maybe earlier, yeah. Right? Like, it's a continuation of a trend, possibly. But then the young guys are all of these, like, podcasters. And I was wondering, like, Amr, I would assume that this lineup was vetted by like people within like the entertainment division, right, of like the Saudi state or something. And there have got to be like millennial podcast guys like everywhere inside of that, right?
Oh yeah, not just the like regular people, but like the princes themselves listening to fucking
exactly
podcasts and shit, man.
Like a lot get Samuel over here. Let's go.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this is like different. It is very like Renaissance-y in a certain way as well, where like this isn't like the state. I mean, it is the state to a degree, but it's this weird like somewhat Renaissance idea of like a certain prince will just push for a certain comedian to go there because they just like them, you know. It is your humble and benevolent patron of the arts spending because they watched you in one movie once and they're like, you know, come over here, I want to see you perform for me and for my subjects, you know. It is very Renaissance-y. I quite like appreciate it in a sort of grim way, like instead of like, you know, comedians having to like hawk, you know, what's it called, FanDuel or BetterHelp, it's called, like,
dick pills.
Instead of having that be the economic model for art, just have like one very, 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 very wealthy guy and like cater to his fucking interests. Why not? It's no better or worse than what we have right now. Why fucking go for it?
Connor, this actually reminds me of like you, like at some of your places of employ, like having to put on like a concert for like the students and like having them like be like, oh, there's a guy on a podcast, I'd really like him to come.
I'd be, you know, all for it, unless there's like his name is Alec or his name is Amr. Okay, no.
Asshole.
Well, I mean, it'd either be like I have to get up on mic with y'all, which is terrible. It's like, well, we see Alec and Amr, but who's that guy in the bottle of Quava?
Yeah, I kind of at the end of this, I wanted to underline again, like how much of this, I think, at just like the bare level, like, and I probably should have led with this, is just us transposing our kind of feelings of political like inadequacy and just channeling like all of those ill feelings that everybody has right now into something else, right? Like given where we are right now, given like what's going on in the world, it's like it's at least obvious to me that like this is an outlet for people to feel self-righteous in a time frame where we like don't have that much good to talk about as Americans, right? Because and in earnest, right, like I think anybody with half a brain knows that we just don't have like a leg to stand on when it comes to this stuff. Anything you say about the Sauds, unfortunately, right, like why do they exist? Why are they there? Like, I wonder who buys all their oil, right? That even makes them so powerful, right?
Who sells them all the weapons? Who sends, you know, the troops? Who trains their pilots? Like, we are you. We're not just you. We're the upgrade of you. We're the, you know.
Yeah, you guys are broke boys. Like, yeah. The Arabs are where it's at, right? Like, not broke boy Americans. Where's your oil money, bro? Where's your check, you know?
Not just on a fiscal level, but like the cultural milieu of like just absorbing everything America creates and just being like, no, you're going to perform here now. I don't care if you had a tour scheduled for like the West Coast or whatever. You know, it's very, I don't know. You're right. I completely agree with your thesis, Alec. I think a lot of it is this like targeting the other, the outsider, because you don't want to reckon with what you've created yourself. But
absolutely,
you know.
And I don't know, did I mention that a lot of Americans are Islamophobic and don't like Muslims? I don't know if I've even said that yet. That's a huge part of it.
Yeah. I do think
we also don't like Muslims.
Yeah, I do think, like, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if the same level of vitriol would be in response to like if these people went to, I don't know, China or Eastern Europe.
It'd be
Europe
like Singapore or something, right? I mean, I mean that is probably another thing, which is like I can't think of a place that exists that's quite like any of the Gulf monarchy states. Like
that's really the problem, right?
Right. Yeah.
You go back to your argument about your thesis about the three different groups of people and their different manifestations of dissent. I would say the right is Islamophobic, yes, but they would also be upset because China is like the also the, like the ultimate enemy, right? The nationalistic enemy. The liberals will be upset because people like civil rights there, whatever. Probably the something to do with the Uyghurs and all of that stuff that they would love. They would get really angry, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. The leftists would probably be like fine with that. I think of the three groups, the leftists are the only ones who would only be angry at the Gulf, as opposed to like, you know, yeah, China or Germany, whatever.
Alec and I talked about this earlier, like those online lefties where it's like the pendulum has been swinging from like obsessing over Japanese culture to obsessing over Chinese culture. And
which way, but Western man? And it's either a weeb or a guy who's really into China.
Yeah.
I've been reading about all these cars I'm not allowed to buy. And I'm really excited for you.
I've been reading nothing but cultivator novels now. I'm on chapter 847. I think what my ultimate thesis is, I guess I'm coming from a comedian or comedy adjacent perspective here, and from like a labor perspective here, I guess it's like, I don't care about this. I'm more interested in seeing the footage or seeing like, hey, now that the festival's over, here's the list of like guidelines we were given, if they're given any, right? Like, yes. I'm way more interested in that.
Yes, 100%. Those are the two things that are for me the most important parts, or the things that are salient to any degree.
Yeah. As for actually going to do the festival, I don't know where this idea comes from that comedians have this like pension plan. I don't know where they could. I think the highest check that they're giving out for this is like $1.6 million. And that's like your Bill Burr, your Louis C.K., like your big headliners. And like entertainment, it comes and goes in waves. Like your podcast is probably like, I don't know. If you're just like a normal podcaster, maybe like $80,000 a year after taxes, like an additional revenue stream. So you're having to do festivals, you're having to do shows, you're having to like constantly fly all over the place. That stuff adds up. There's no health insurance unless you're like in SAG or the WGA. And so I really do have like a bit of sympathy for like, we don't have a patronage system in America. And so this is kind of how like artists and comedians have to make money. So at that case, like, I don't fucking care. I think it'd be, what did we say? Like,
the most explicit line is Israel. Like, I will care only.
Yes, that's what Alec and I say. Like, I'm not about to go like perform on the Tel Aviv Killing It Festival, like right next to and
bombing for Israel. How about that?
Like something like that, where it's just like, and you know, it's revealed that like Netanyahu's just like, oh yeah, before I went into politics, I was BB the clown and I wanted to be a children's entertainer. Like, no, we're never gonna, I would never, look, I'm saying it right now. Propagandos will never perform at a Tel Aviv comedy
in Israel.
We're drawing that line in the sand.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, again, right, like, I'm a lefty.
I think we're 1 year away from the U.S. administration forcing every podcaster to go to Israel.
Like, well, you know what?
Like, at gunpoint, putting every single podcaster and comedian on plane and being like, if you don't go to Israel, we will execute you.
I get thrown into a van and it's like Connor's like hog tied up and they take me to the Lake Charles Municipal Airport and I'm immediately flown, him and me, to Tel Aviv.
Yeah.
So that we can
you, Marin, fucking the Chapo guys, the a fucking month of,
oh shit,
my first podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just like sitting next to Matt Chrisman, it's like, oh shit, man!
Not only is it like mandatory legally, like we're just forcing everyone. Like, we're just, you're zero, but we're making long march to Tel Aviv.
In that case, if that happens, I can't wait to go to Tel Aviv. Propaganda is performing on stage D at 12:45.
I know it is fun to like be woke and I think to be mad about stuff, but like at the end of the day, like everything else aside, all of like the smart points or whatever, it's just like, this is what you're mad about right now. You know, like I just,
who fucking
that part
cares?
Is just drives me nuts. That's all I have to say about it, right? Like
There's actual like entertainment issues happening here in America that Americans can get really upset about, and instead they're getting mad over a fucking dumb comedy festival. whatever.
Well, and they're being, and you know that, like, you know that people are kind of like really feeling their oats when it's just like the most smug like tweets about this, and it's like, yeah. You really don't have anything else going on. So the news was too depressing to keep reading, huh? And you wanted like to take that off ramp to some other topic.
That we're all politically impotent, right? Because if we can't control politics, we can control culture. We can harangue a comedian to cancel a trip to Dubai. We could annoy a fucking musician enough to say that they're not going to perform at this festival that another musician is performing in because that second musician is right wing or whatever. It's ultimately we admit that we've lost the political war but won the culture war. So we're going to continue on the hill of culture because that's all we have here. Like
that's true.
And I mean the liberals and the left or whatever you want to call us, the non-right.
I also want to add on to what I was saying about like from a labor perspective is America. The entertainment industry took massive hits, not just from COVID, but also the writer strike from last year. And like a lot of these people were impacted by that. Like Hollywood productions kind of just like shut down for a little bit. And so I think some of these folks, I am spitballing here. I mean, a lot of these people are podcasters, so they had revenue streams coming from them. But if they are in SAG or WGA, they weren't working. They weren't making money. And I think, God, am I really just defending, like, go to Riyadh and get your bag? Do I really need to defend Dave Chappelle's hurting, y'all? Like, these aren't small comedians. Cut this. I don't want this in there. These people have, like, millions of dollars.
I don't give a fuck, man. I mean, I actually do think that defend your bag is, like, a principal point.
Also,
I'm sorry.
How different is this from actors and comedians and performers doing work for, what's it called, the USO?
Yeah, that's what I was
none. Okay. None at all.
Actually, I would argue that the U.S. Army has more bodies on it by orders of magnitude than the Saudis. By orders of magnitude.
Close.
Yeah.
It's not close. You're going to
fucking like Saigon and performing. I mean, you know, that is historically, but I guess. But fucking, Iraq, like going to the fucking
green zone and performing. Yeah.
How different is that? I don't know, man.
I don't think it's that different. And furthermore, like if
that would pay better, I'll tell you that much.
if we really want to go like bird's eye view macroeconomics on here, like if you take a corporate gig at say like a Facebook event or Raytheon or Shell or something like that, like you are I'm just such a believer that like boycotting on these levels is just like futile. I truly do believe that. Like people are serving on the boards of several different companies, and I just think your money's dirty no matter what. There are, like you said, Amr, there is a line in the sand that you can draw, but we all draw them ourselves arbitrarily.
Outside of the universal line of Israel, everyone else draws their lines differently. Like, some people think the line is drawn at Gulf Monarchy. Some people think it's corporate retreats or whatever. And whatever. I understand the sort of pull and push that you have to do as a person, as a performer, someone in the arts or the cultural spaces. Because let's face it, like fucking like an alternative bar or whatever where you just do leftist speak or whatever, you're not going to pay the bills with that. And maybe that is the correct moral position, is you only perform in these like open mic nights and then you work a second job. Maybe that is the position. I've been thinking about that. Like maybe the position of like professionalizing sports has backfired and now we should just all have Sunday league. That's the only thing you get. Sunday league, you go there with your friends, that's it. There's no televised sports, there's no professional athletes. No one gets paid, no one gets broadcast any TV. You want to watch football, you go to the local pitch and you watch other fat dads play around. Maybe that's the solution. I don't know. I'm like on a moral level, it's all fucking pernicious. It's all tainted by Pandora's box of money,
Yeah. No, I'm not trying to be silly here, but I do think about like what would propaganda sound like if one, this was our job. Like we made money off of this and this was our job. And we had to have regular episodes every single week,
put
right?
So much less effort into it. I'm kind of promise.
Or what if we didn't have to worry about consequences of things that we say on the podcast? What if we didn't have to worry about, like, or what if we did have to worry about keeping the sponsors happy? Like, how do these things change your art form? Because it's a big difference between getting up on stage and doing stand up and making sure that, you know, Me Undies or DraftKings isn't pissed off at you, right?
Yeah.
I mean, okay, so Andrew Santino, who is on the Riyadh Comedy Festival, he has a special, a stand up special that he put out on Hulu. And he's spoken about how he had to like edit some stuff out about his jokes about Disney adults and Hulu's owned by Disney. So even your stand up specials are just like being hacked away at. And like you have to just self release them at this point. So, Amar, I think you, I don't know if that is the answer. I'm not saying it's not. But I think you've really tapped into something here of like, it really is like you've got to have a secondary source of income other than your art to make sure that your art isn't sullied by that money.
Yeah, honestly, I got into this argument with some friends over the weekend at a friend's birthday party about how salary caps are actually against workers. Because if players create value in sports, right? Because the value of the player is playing the fucking thing, right? So any attempt to suppress their wages, all the excess money is going to the fucking, you know, the owners, right? Like it's not being donated to fucking soup kitchens. It's going to,
yeah,
to the owner's pocket. Because my argument was like introducing salary caps, like European football is just gonna do the same thing, which is in America, which is all the money goes to the oligarch owners. Whereas the more money players get, the more pro-labor it is because they're the ones creating the fucking value of obviously them and the coaching staff and all of that. But then my flip side of that I've come to after this podcast is like, well, yeah, why not just have all the players have second jobs? Everything is semi-pro now. You're a mall security guy and then you play football on the weekends. And that's the maximum we ever get with arts and sports or whatever. I don't know. It's very...
Amar, are you familiar with there's a scandal roiling American basketball right now with Kawhi Leonard
stuff? Yeah. I mean, I'm a Raptors guy. I'm a Raptors.
Okay. All right. There you go. There you go. So you're a Kawhi man. Alec, are you familiar with this?
No, God, no.
So in the NBA, you do have salary caps for like what you're allowed to pay like in total. So your entire payout for your entire roster has a cap instead of like individual people, and they hit that cap and Kawhi is playing for the Clippers and the owner of the Clippers
is, he's being paid under the table to like plant trees or something,
not under the table. He has a side job at one of Steve Ballmer's side businesses. Ballmer, the owner of the Clippers, and so like that's how they get around the salary.
Good for him. You know, sometimes you got a moonlight to make ends meet, you know, Connor.
Okay, do we have anything else to say about the Riyadh Comedy Festival or comedy or yada yada?
Catch me at the Riyadh Festival next year. Yeah.
I will be performing.
Yeah. Yeah, can't wait to for Propagandos to do a special on how Kamal Khashoggi really was kind of a liar.
Yeah, a real jerk. We talked to guys that worked with him, and they weren't big fans.
All right, on that note, excelsior, Propagandos, and as always, keep your eyes on the skies.
Get yourself a sweet Madonna dressed in Cranstone setting off pedestal of abalone shell. Going 95 scary, 'cause I got the Virgin Mary assuring me that I won't go to